Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Maybe for a change, we could call it the employment report. The May jobs numbers came out today, quite a handy gain, and the unemployment rate remains steady. So would that be good news or bad? Well, as always, depends on who you ask. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. It's the 1st of June today. There were officially 157,000 new places to work in this country in May. That's what the Labor Department told us this morning. It's a nice bounce back from the past couple of months. So we got Nigel Gault, U.S. economist at Global Insight, on the line to help understand where the new jobs came from all of a sudden.
Well, the jobs in May came, as they usually come in most recent months, in the service sector. We're still losing jobs in manufacturing. Construction jobs were flat, so it was services that did all the work.
Such as?
We were gaining jobs in health, in education, leisure and hospitality, including drinking and eating places, which is encouraging, since you might think people would cut back on eating out with higher gasoline prices.
That's great, but really, so what? It's just a single report for just part of the economy.
I think the main thing we can take out of this is if you put the employment together with a number of other reports, it suggests that the economy is bouncing back in the second quarter from the anemic 0.6% GDP growth rate in the first.
Nigel Gault from the forecasting firm Global Insight. There were a couple of other economic odds and ends that we found out about today. One of the Fed's key measures of inflation, something called personal consumption expenditures, rose just 2% in April year over year. That's a bit dense, so here's the real takeaway. For the first time in more than a year, inflation's right where Ben Bernanke wants it to be. Congress is back at work next week. Budget negotiators will be using all of their insight. They'll be churning through appropriations bills for the various executive departments. And the White House wants to know exactly what lawmakers are up to. A memo from the Office of Management and Budget orders agency heads to pass along the specifics of congressional earmarks, those pet projects that always seem to find their way into spending bills. Marketplace's Hillary Wakay reports.
The Office of Management and Budget plans to put all of that earmark information in a database for legislators and taxpayers to see. Steve McMillan is the deputy director at OMB. He says the goal is simple.
We'd like the information to be available to inform the legislative process.
Government watchdogs are also all about improving transparency and cutting back on airbrushing extra spending into bills in the dead of night. They call this database a good step, but wonder if it'll really cut down on spending. Nick Schwellenbach with the Project on Government Oversight says there are already reports of legislators finding ways to run silent and deep and continue to slip that spending into bills.
Legislators are getting in touch with the agencies and having those agencies request what the legislators would have in the past just simply earmarked. So now it doesn't look like an earmark anymore, but it's essentially the same thing.
And some Democrats complain the database is a bit disingenuous. It will only contain congressional earmarks and not the White House's earmarks. Representative Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, is a member of the fiscally conservative Blue Dog Coalition.
The White House, if it wants to be fair, shouldn't give their own earmarks any preference over congressional earmarks. We're an equal branch of government.
At OMB Watch, one senior advisor agrees that's a tough spot that might require a bit more Windex for true transparency. He says in terms of legislative earmarks, the database will be outstanding. In terms of executive earmarks, he gives it an F. In Washington, I'm Hillary Wakay for Marketplace.
dig into those job numbers Nigel Gault was telling us about, and you get a pretty good picture of the housing industry. Still sagging, not much residential construction going on, in part because of the subprime mortgage market. In Massachusetts today, a state official issued emergency regulations to stop what she calls widespread fraud, fraud that's targeting people in danger of losing their homes. The Bay State's Attorney General, Martha Coakley, said scam artists who promise to rescue homeowners from foreclosure are actually out to steal those homes. Foreclosures are on the rise in Massachusetts, as elsewhere, so Coakley said she's looking at increased regulation of other deceptive mortgage lending practices, too. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli has the story.
Rescue scammers promise homeowners help with refinancing or selling their homes, but Attorney General Coakley says that kind of help often comes at too high a price.
A predator rescuer comes in to say, I can help, but demands that the property itself be turned over to the rescuer. And what is a bad situation, it may end up in losing the home or losing equity, becomes immediately worse and actually mostly irreparable.
Coakley says these rescue schemes are, quote, rife with fraud. They often include illegally misleading promises, and they leave distressed homeowners with little recourse, hence today's emergency action. Coakley also wants to hear what the public has to say about other mortgage lending practices that she says are frequently unfair or deceptive.
Particularly when the borrower's income is overstated or when the loan is made at a very small rate for the first 2 years that balloons up.
She says these practices cause more than lost homes. They're also causing urban blight in Massachusetts as lost homes are boarded up. It's a problem nationwide. Coakley says other states may be zeroing in on rescue schemes as well as other questionable lending practices.
I am certain that other states, whether it's with their attorneys general or their secretaries of state or the legislatures, are all looking at how this came about and looking at ways to fix it.
Coakley also appealed to private Massachusetts lawyers today. She wants them to offer free help to homeowners facing foreclosure while efforts to draw up new laws are underway. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Maybe Detroit turned around while nobody was looking. Car makers announced May sales today. And for the first time in a good long while, there's a bright spot. Two of them, actually. General Motors reported sales were up almost 10%, mostly on pickup trucks. And Chrysler's U.S. sales rose 4.3%. Ford lost ground, down about 7%. That helped fuel its drop to third place worldwide behind Toyota, where sales were up almost 14%. More records, broad-based gains, the man from Dallas. Who could ask for anything more? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Wall Street's clipping right along, but the Shanghai Composite Index has had a rough week. The benchmark index ended trading today down more than 5% from where it started on Monday. For now, shareholders are mostly sitting tight, but when they do decide to sell, as they inevitably will, businesses on the losing end of those trades could wind up going under. So investors and executives are paying special attention to a new corporate bankruptcy law that took effect today. Our Shanghai correspondent Scott Tong reports on China's latest stop on the road to a free market economy.
This is the sound of a Chinese company going under. It's a corporate bankruptcy auction in Shanghai. Here, a company's four-year-old minivan is getting liquidated for $10,000. In China, the money from these auctions tends to go to the bankrupt company employees to pay their wages and pension benefits. Anything left over goes to the banks that gave loans to the company, the creditors. Corporate lawyer Susan Monroe says putting workers first in line is a holdover from old-school China, when the state provided cradle-to-grave protection for the workers. They called it the Iron Rice Bowl.
The focus of the government was on employees, on making sure that people have the wherewithal to earn a livelihood and have their basic needs met.
Today's new law is part of modern free market China, meaning creditors get to go to the front of the bankruptcy line, just like in the U.S. and much of the rest of the world. Attorney Dan Rules considers this a big deal for banks in China. He says before, they didn't get much of their money back when loans went sour. So in some cases, they didn't lend in the first place, especially to the new, smaller businesses. But now they have more faith they'll be repaid.
Typically, the creditors just have not been willing to take the risk. That's why the law should be helpful in facilitating further lending than was available before.
He says the bankruptcy law provides a smooth, orderly process for struggling firms to go under and pay off their debts so everyone can then move on. And the moving on is the key here. He says someday China will hit a recession, and it needs an efficient way to ditch the weaker companies and get going again.
Now is the opportunity to put some of these mechanisms in place so that whenever that time comes, they will be there and allow for a less painful process of thinning the ranks of inefficient operations.
The new law sets tough deadlines for companies to liquidate. A process that used to take years can now get squeezed into just 2 months. The poster child of what not to do is Japan in the 1990s. Banks there kept ailing companies on life support, says Shanghai lawyer Zhou Yongsheng.
Japanese banks were very slow to clear out bad debt and non-performing loans, so they suffered when the economic bubble popped and took a long time to recover.
So will China's new law trigger a sudden wave of bankruptcies? No one really thinks so. It's one thing for Beijing to pass a law. It's quite another for the central government to exert its will and compel companies and judges out in the hinterlands to implement it. In time, though, most think the new bankruptcy law will take root. And when it does, make for a more competitive survival of the fittest Chinese economy, one where the inefficient businesses, like the dodo bird, just won't fly. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Not a bad week for you there, big guy, huh?
Yeah, you know, in fact, here's to four-day weeks.
That's right. We ought to have them more often for a whole lot of reasons.
I know. I'm all for it. You know, if I did work on commission, I think it'd be a darn good thing. No, in four, just this has been really a rollicking year so far. If you look back, some of the numbers are unbelievable. We just finished the best quarter for the Dow Jones Industrials Average since the fourth quarter of 1998. The Dow Jones Industrials Average has scored 26 new all-time closing highs as of this one today. This has just been remarkable.
But, of course, the big news this week really was the S&P. I mean, you know, the Dow's almost a yawn by now.
No, well, I know that. I mean, you can't take it for granted. It's made a lot of people a lot of money. And the S&P average is the one that's, you know, that most of the experts follow. And that one had been almost, what, 7 years, I guess, since we've seen a new all-time high there. And of course, the NASDAQ, I don't know that the NASDAQ is going to make a new all-time high
ever
during our kids' lifetime. It's got to more than double. But see, there's an interesting story here. If you look at the progression of what's been going on this year, and it's been going on for a while here, is the Dow Jones Industrials Average has outperformed the S&P 500. And the S&P 500 has outperformed the NASDAQ. And you can go on down the list. And you know what? You know what the differentiation is?
No, no. Bill Gates, as they say.
The differentiation for right now and for what's been going on for this year is the international component, the global component. We talked about this several months ago on the show.
Yeah, we did.
But just to remind people, or for the perhaps number of people we could count on our left hand who happened to miss that show, you look at the revenues from the big stocks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average stocks, and in many, 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 many cases, it's over 50% outside of the United States. 85% of the revenues for Intel come offshore. McDonald's, Coca-Cola, all the big guys. Mm-hmm. And that's where the growth has been. It's the international markets that have done so well. And a lot of our companies invest over there. And a lot of these S&P 500 companies don't, and a lot less of the NASDAQ do.
So what we have here, really, today's job numbers aside, is that it's still corporate profits driving things, right?
Yeah, it is. It's just not necessarily all from here, but that's really naive to just think that you invest only for the United States. If you're trying to make money, you might as well spread it around. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
As we try so often not to do on this program.
Exactly. In fact, that's why we offer you so many baskets in the offhand chance that one of them will make you money, and we can point with great pride to that one. All right, I've been making all these new highs all week. I'm kind of tired.
All right, you got to go. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Good to be with you, Kai.
See you next time. Coming up, filling the void on library shelves.
80% of the preschools and after schools we serve have not a single book for the children in their program.
But first, let's do the numbers. Some big deals had Wall Street sitting pretty on this Friday. The Dow Industrials gussied up 40 points, 0.3%, to end the day at 13,668. The NASDAQ shined ahead 9 points, 0.3%, to close at 26,13. The S&P 500 spruced up 5 points, 0.3%, to end at another record high of 1536. For the week, the Dow jumped 1.2%. The NASDAQ gained nearly 2.25%. The S&P 500 was up 1.3%. Looks like everything really does have a price. Dow Jones says it's now ready to talk about a $5 billion bid from Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. Greed is always a good thing in Wall Street's eyes. Dow Jones flipped up nearly 15%. Today, News Corp jumped 2.5%. Those car sales we mentioned earlier got investors revved up on transportation. Despite a slip in sales, Ford Motor roared ahead 0.1%. Daimler Chrysler shares got a boost of 0.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Waitress, a comedy about a diner waitress who finds inspiration in motherhood, friendship, and pies. In select theaters now. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. The Commerce Department reports on factory orders for the month of April. The Consumer Federation of America releases an independent survey of consumer attitudes toward the real estate industry. And China intends to share details of its national plan to combat climate change. The outline comes a couple of days in advance of the G8 meeting in Germany, where global warming will be a hot topic. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I say Nielsen, chances are you think television ratings. The company's made millions selling those audience figures to broadcasters, which then charge advertisers billions to peddle their products to those audiences. Modern technology has been a boon to both sides of that equation. Networks know much more specifically how many people are watching their shows. And thanks to some new data out this week, advertisers know how many are or aren't watching their commercials. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
TV executives watch TV too. They know that sometimes you just flip to another channel during commercials, and if you have a DVR, a digital video recorder, you can just fast forward. James McQuivey with Forrester Research says $70 billion in ad revenue is at stake. So the TV networks wanted to keep what happens during the commercials a mystery.
They're just afraid that if we find out that nobody's watching the commercials, that they won't be able to charge as much money.
About 17% of Americans have DVRs. Nielsen's study is the first to look at how many DVR users actually watch ads. The data suggests more than half of viewers skip them, fewer than some had feared. Advertisers have long argued they should pay less for the airtime if people aren't watching. Try convincing the TV companies. James McQuivey says fall ad rates will probably remain steady.
The goal of the network is to preserve revenue. So if it means they raise rates in order to keep the revenue at the same level, they will do that.
The proliferation of channels and shows on the internet has also put pressure on ad rates. Brian Steinberg with Advertising Age says the people making commercials will have to come up with creative tricks to get us to watch TV ads.
I think we're going to see more attention paid to product placement, putting products into shows with new commercial formats, like taking over an entire commercial break.
Nielsen's revised rating system will also measure how many people tune in live and how many use their DVRs to watch a few days later. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Almost a week ago, the most popular television network in Venezuela went off the air. President Hugo Chavez decided not to renew the broadcast license for RCTV. The station had been openly critical of Chavez's rule, and the decision to shut it down has been politically unpopular. Thousands of protesters have been in the streets of Caracas this week. We've got Marketplace's Dan Gretsch on the line from the Americas desk down at WLRN in Miami. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Kai.
So what is the Chavez administration doing about these protests and about calming things down?
First off, Chavez has completely stood his ground. He's actually even threatened the only other remaining opposition channel, Globovisión. But in an effort to perhaps mollify some of these students, he's announced a raft of new education measures, including opening more than 24 free public universities over the next 6 years. He's also increasing need-based scholarships. And while these things have been criticized as ways to kind of buy off these protesters, they're also consistent with his administration's efforts to make education less expensive for the poor.
Do you think it's going to work? Not all the protesters are students.
What makes these protests unique in the recent history, in the last 8 years of the Chavez administration, is that they're led by students. Students basically have stayed out of the fight up until now. They tend to have leftist sympathies, and Chavez is a leftist. But when it came to a case of freedom of expression, it seems to really have hit a nerve with students. But you're right. This is generally a middle-class protest, and you can hear banging pots and pans all throughout middle-class neighborhoods in Caracas and other major cities. Will Chavez be able to calm this? Will this kind of boil over, or will this spread and intensify? No one knows.
Is this one of those protests, or has this been a series of protests that is shutting down parts of daily life down there?
Well, certainly in the areas of town in the center of Caracas where these protests are taking place, businesses are shuttered. Daily life has essentially come to a standstill. But one kind of interesting wrinkle in this is the fact that they just took off the air the nation's largest broadcaster with a 30% audience share. And the advertisers that had been on that channel really have nowhere else to go because all of the other channels are pretty much saturated in terms of their advertising. So a lot of these big companies are sitting on a lot of extra ad revenue that they don't really know what to do with.
RCTV, while it's nominally, I suppose, off the air in Venezuela, Dan, I read today a piece in the Newswires that they're uploading segments of their programming to YouTube, and they've got an affiliate in Colombia that's broadcasting into Venezuela as well. So in a way, they're getting around President Chavez's restrictions.
You could say that. I mean, they're certainly using 21st century technology to their advantage. But it should be mentioned that the kind of audience that they're reaching, the number of people that they're reaching with these measures, are a tiny fraction of the millions they used to reach with the nation's most popular television news shows. They're expected to reach about 800,000 people through a cable broadcast from Colombia's Caracol network and, you know, probably a relatively small audience through YouTube. But they are still on the air, and that gives a certain amount of hope that they might eventually actually be able to broadcast again.
Dan Gretsch covers South America for us from the Americas desk at WLRN down in Miami. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan's been keeping himself in the media spotlight, as I think we've mentioned a couple of times on the program. He's talked about the possibility of recession recently, and he said some unflattering things about the Chinese stock market, too. If you've got $35, you can read for yourself what he's got to say about his time running the central bank. His memoir comes out this fall, The Age of Turbulence, it'll be called. And as part of his PR campaign, he was the keynote speaker today at Book Expo America in New York City. One of the most impressive stories at the expo, though, isn't a new release. It's a nonprofit group that's found a new market in an historically tough industry. Alex Goldmark has more.
About a dozen young girls wearing oversized yellow T-shirts are finishing up their homework here at Sister Power, an after-school and mentoring center in East Harlem. Founder Cynthia Kirkpatrick shows me around.
This is the favorite hangout, believe it or not. This is the library, and most of these books come to us from First Book.
First Book is a nonprofit group that gets new books to low-income children through groups like Sister Power. Kirkpatrick is both able to stock this 1,000-book library and give out books for keeps.
I think that, honestly, I think that they would not have a library at home, because if we only had 150 books, we would have to keep all those books in-house. We would not be in a position to give out books or give out as many books.
There is a tremendous chasm of need for books in the lives of children.
That's Kyle Zimmer, the founder of First Book.
80% of the preschools and after schools we serve have not a single book for the children in their program.
One obstacle is these kids just can't afford new books. Another is that publishers willing to donate books or sell them at a steep discount face tremendous logistical problems in delivering small quantities of the right reading material to hundreds of thousands of after-school programs. So, First Book is banding them together. Over 15,000 small groups so far. Add in some sophisticated inventory software, and these low-income groups become a viable market.
When you begin adding up that program with one two blocks down, with one three blocks over, and you go across the country through our hundreds of communities, now you're talking about a market force that can be transformative for the publishing industry, and it can be transformative for literacy and reading in the United States.
The grassroots groups pick out titles at a website First Book makes available just for them. Then, First Book uses a patchwork of donated warehouse space to receive and distribute millions of books each year. In fact, the process is so efficient that it can actually save a publisher money to give the books away.
Books sitting in a warehouse aren't going to do anybody any good.
Alexandra Nash is in charge of non-bookstore sales for Candlewick Press. When they redesigned the cover of their Judy Moody book series, the older version was still in their warehouse.
It costs us to keep them there. And by donating these books to First Book, or in some cases selling them, it gives us an option to lower some of those inventory levels and keep them where we need them to be.
So the girls at Sister Power and other groups get a brand new Judy Moody book for 10% of the cover price. And who knows, maybe the publishing industry will get new retail customers down the line.
When I grow up, I think I would go to the reading store because I would love to read books more when I grow up, since I love books now.
Can't love them if you don't have them. In East Harlem, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, last week we told you about some tainted toothpaste from China. Officials in the Dominican Republic and Panama had pulled the brands Mr. Cool and Excel from their shelves. The problem's an ingredient called diethylene glycol. Great in antifreeze, bad in your mouth. Now that same ingredient's made its way into some toothpastes here. U.S. health officials found traces of it in brands sold at discount stores. Cool Dents, the brand name. The FDA advises staying clear of any toothpaste made in China, even if it's a great deal. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 40 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ jumped 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 bumped up 5 points again around 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, crime and economic inequality.
And in a lot of mid-size and large cities, we're seeing significant spikes in violent crime. Not all crime, but in violent crime.
Hate to leave you with that, but have a good weekend anyway. And hey, let's be safe out there.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.